that time.
Thanks. Both David and Daniel have really set in context how the disaster occurred, and it really succinctly put as well. And I think the comments David made are comments I've made very often over the years, because even to families, a lot of the families saw Hillsborough in isolation. They just didn't see the politics of how those things happened, and you know the reference. And really, what Daniel has just described, that's what happens when people are treated like animals. Because, as David pointed out, the whole thing around how fans were treated, it was even within police instructions. Visiting fans were corralled from the station to the ground and put into pens. They were herded into pens like animals. My involvement in Hillsborough came about, one, because you know I'm from Liverpool, and like everybody on that day, I didn't lose anyone at Hillsborough, and I wasn't at Hillsborough, but I can remember where I was when I found out something was happening there, and I had friends and family who were there, and I can remember waiting and listening for messages, and listening to the roll call the next day on the radio of people's names being read out, waiting for names I knew, glad when they weren't read out, and then feeling guilty because those names, they were someone's sons, daughters, etc. For a time, Liverpool at that time reacted quite swiftly in terms of, as an authority, believe it or not, the City Council actually set up a disaster working party. In the City Council at that time, what you had was the remnants of any rebelliousness in the city. So you had an independent Labour group, and quite a few of them had been at Hillsborough, and they set up this disaster working party, and I assisted them in a voluntary capacity. And then I was employed as an academic researcher on what was known as the Hillsborough Project, and my role was to monitor all the legal proceedings. So I spent a lot of time in Sheffield and attended all the inquests. And right from the word go, I had a sense that something was wrong, not just from the time of... We knew it was lies, what was being told in the Sun and the defamatory headlines. But when I started my research, what I came face to face with was authority and how people in authority lie to your face. And I've always had great difficulty with people lying to me from when I was a child, and kind of I got the bit between my teeth on that one, and you know, 20 years on, I'm still around in one form or another. But to just take you briefly through it, after the deaths, the inquests were opened and adjourned, you know, as is normal for bodies to be released. And normally what would happen, the inquest would stay adjourned until the DPP had decided whether any prosecutions would arise out of the disaster or not. In this case, what happened was the coroner brought about these, what became known as mini inquests. And what that was, a limited phase of the inquest, just to release evidence as to where the person was when they were in the pen, where they were in the pen, what time they'd left home, etc., etc. And it was argued that was to help the families. Well, no way was it to help the families. What it did actually was set the scene, because, and I was there firsthand, and you saw it from the first day on. What happened was, in each and every case, a pathologist read out the name, age of each person, and the blood alcohol level of that individual. And so that brings you to the point of the, you know, of victim blaming, because at that time 95 people had died. Tony Bland was still in a persistent vegetative state, so was we say 96, but at that point it was 95. So you had the obscene situation of blood alcohol level being read out against a 10-year-old boy who died. And they, you know, that was the level it got to. So you see the creation of a scene being set in which, along with what David has said was, you know, how football supporters, what was the makeup of football supporters? And really, when you set it in context, football supporters generally were seen within the context of violence and of unruliness generally, and, you know, hence why they were being used to bring in ID cards under Thatcher. And Liverpool generally at that time had a very negative reputation. It had a reputation for militancy, which I think, I think it's quite a conservative place to be, but that's another story. But it did have this reputation, so you had that together, you know, Liverpool football supporters, and they were Liverpool fans. And so, you know, what else do? You try and create the scene that somehow they were complicit in their own debts, or their fellow fans were responsible for the debts. And so hence the lies and the headlines in the early days. And then the blood alcohol levels. Now, you know, for what it's worth, the blood alcohol levels in many were zero, or and in some they were above the level for driving. Who was driving? You know, if you took the blood alcohol level in theatre goers, what's it going to be? These people had gone to a sporting event, a social event, and they were somehow being considered complicit in their own deaths. So that set the scene, and really the evidence given, and this was very clear, and this brings in the lawyers acting for the families, because one of my big criticisms of the whole Hillsborough thing is the poor quality of representation by the Hillsborough Steering Committee of Solicitors. It was set up and they just fell short of ambulance chasing, but in some instances they did knock on doors 2 days after and were getting people to sign pieces of paper. I was speaking with Joan Tootle, who lost her son just the other week, and we were talking about how she said she didn't know what she was doing, and the next thing she was getting letters off this guy saying, "I'm representing you." Then she remembered signing this piece of paper. She thought someone had just come to pay the respects about her son dying. So they had agreed, the solicitors representing the families had agreed that these inquests would take place in this limited phase, and that no evidence would be challenged. So you had the bizarre situation, you'd be sitting in court, the solicitor representing the families would be sitting there. This contentious stuff was coming one way, but couldn't be challenged. And it was horrendous. And to take one example, where slightly contentious stuff was challenged, was around quite a high profile case, or became high profile, Kevin Williams. Because there was evidence, the police in a throwaway comment said, "Oh, someone said he spoke at 4 o'clock. And very quickly, they got onto the fact that, well, someone's going to pick up on this. So that was the Wednesday. The Thursday, the investigating officers, and I'll come onto the West Midlands Police in a minute, they went to, ironically enough, the two key witnesses were both police officers, one a Merseyside police officer who was attending the game as a supporter, and the other was a South Yorkshire special constable, who both had evidence that this boy was alive on the pitch and then was alive in the gymnasium. And the West Midlands Police visited both of them in their homes and exerted tremendous pressure on them to alter their statements. By the Friday, the coroner had brought in an expert to give evidence that the boy couldn't possibly have been alive. And if any movement was seen, it was nerve endings. No way was he twitching. It was something that had occurred after brain death, etc. And it was a case of blinding you with science, as subsequently found out having meetings with other pathologists. So that set the scene for the lies, really. But in a naive jury, but also a Sheffield jury that had been influenced, no two ways about it, by the press, you'd be hard-pushed not to be influenced, given the coverage in Sheffield was pretty bad. And that's not a slur on anyway on the people of Sheffield, because in the main, the support they gave families on the day and subsequently was amazing. The press was pretty harsh, but a scene was set for the jury. And then what happened was, and it is crucial to this, after the disaster, South Yorkshire Police, as is, you know, the norm, had to bring in another police force, ask another police force to investigate what had gone on. So they invited West Midlands Police in, who, and a few years earlier, South Yorkshire, West Midlands Police had invited South Yorkshire Police in to investigate them at another stage. So you see how it all works. But basically, the West Midlands Police were to become the investigating force for all the inquiries into Hillsborough. They investigated South Yorkshire Police. They were the coroner's officers. They provided the evidence for the coroner, and they provided the evidence for the Director of Public Prosecutions. So you had the notorious West Midlands police force, some of whom were former members of the now or then disbanded Serious Crime Squad. And in fact, ahead of the former of the Serious Crime Squad played a pivotal role at the inquest. And he was so dirty. I mean, the stuff on him. Questions had been asked in the House of Commons prior to Hillsborough about this particular officer because of a case where he had set someone up and they'd spent 18 months in Winston Green Prison. And this officer, I can remember being rung up where I worked, and it was this officer, and he said to me, Stanley Beachy was the guy's name if you want to check him out, but this is the guy, and he said to me, I'm just ringing up to ask you, are you thinking of coming to Sheffield tomorrow? I'd never spoken to the man, you know, so I said, of course I'll be there. And he said, well, it's just a courtesy call to tell you don't bother because you won't be allowed in. And I said, I won't be allowed into Sheffield or to the inquest. And he said, just don't come. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll come and you can tell me to my face. And so I was with families, and then he backed down and I went in. But that was the level of, you were getting this intimidation. When I was in Sheffield, I saw I was being singled out because I was sort of aside from families, although I knew them. And I was followed around Sheffield a lot by West Midlands Police. My home was broken into twice in Liverpool, and the only things taken was to frighten you, you know. There was things that, you know, if there had been someone wanting easy money, they could have sold, but stuff was, address book was taken, etc. And, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But the point in that, it was this discredited police force headed up the inquiry into Hillsborough. And I've said, and I make no bones about it, I think they were brought in because of their expertise. And their expertise was cover-up and fabricating evidence. And they did a good job. They exerted great pressure on witnesses, credible witnesses, witnesses, you know, withstanding. So when it came to the final phase of the inquest, because the DPP then ruled no prosecutions, insufficient evidence. Any questions the families asked their solicitor, challenge this, at the mini inquest, they were told no, wait till the final inquest, then we'll have our say, then we'll go for them. And of course, the final inquest just were generic in nature. The inquests were dealt with as if there were one inquest, and the coroner imposed the now famous 3:15 cut-off time. His argument was, in line with what Daniel said, was, we just use that time as a marker. It's a good a time as any. It's more or less the time the first ambulance arrived on the pitch, which was 17 minutes past three, I think. But he said it's as good a time as any. Everyone would have been dead. Or if they weren't dead, they would have sustained the injuries and were beyond saving at that time. So they effectively ruled out any investigation into the emergency response within the coroner's court, which could have affected the verdict. It certainly could have brought in a verdict which incorporated lack of care into the verdict. So there was gaping holes in the evidence given, and a lot of medics who were at the ground as supporters, John Ashton, who at that time was Professor of Public Health at Liverpool University and then World Health Organization, he gave evidence to the Taylor inquiry, and he's very scathing of the emergency response, of the ambulance response specifically, and said there was no triage at all. And he was criticised at Taylor. Taylor more or less said he wasn't a proper doctor because he didn't work in a hospital then. And then he was, because of the 3:15 cut-off, his evidence wasn't even heard. So, and there were other medical personnel whose evidence never got to the coroner. And so you had the bizarre situation at the final stage of the inquest where families I always remember this, being in Manchester at a business meeting, this is what they used to call them, for the inquest, and being with the steering committee and the barristers to see if they wanted, if the families were going to, you know, choose them to represent them. And I remember the chair of the steering committee saying, well, you get what you pay for. If you want Rolls-Royce representation, you've got to pay for it. And basically, what families did was pay for that. And, you know, someone said they got a clapped out old Mini in terms of the representation. Each family paid £3,500. They could pay that because people's generosity in the disaster fund, which when people got money, that money just went in legal fees. And basically, they got appalling representation. And people were disregarded. One woman I met before, Joan Tootle, her son Peter had died, and her husband, also called Peter, I was with him every day at the inquest, attended every day, never heard the son's name mentioned once. So people were paying for that level of representation, and there was just nothing about their individual child or husband. And it really was appalling, and a few times I said to families, you need to go for judicial review on this point or that point. And they'd listen to me, and then they'd go to the people representing them, and they'd say, no, no, leave it till the end, put all your eggs in one basket. You know, and they're paying for that representation, so you can't criticise them for taking that opinion. And what happened after that was when the accidental death verdicts came out, they then went back to the lawyers, and the lawyers said, nothing we can do, basically. And the money had run out by that stage, and it was appalling. The sounds that will stay with me forevermore, and the sound in the courtroom when they brought in the accidental death verdict still moves me tremendously, and individual mothers, I can still hear it in my head. And what happened was Daniel knows the family, John Glover's wife, Teresa, was taken out the court because she was screaming, and the coroner adjourned, and she was she just passed out in the corridor, and they came to us and they said, get her off that corridor, she's a fire risk, and dragged us, and I remember dragging her and one of her sons and me, dragging her into this little ante room. And then when we went back in, the coroner then finally said, if there's any noise at all, whatever. And I always remember, and it's just this defiance, that just is what I love about some of these people, is probably one of the most, you know, sort of this retired school teacher, she was never going to rock any boats, she was never going to stand up and shout about anything, you know, my whole perception of her. And as the coroner said, and there will be silence as the coroner walks out of court, and he walks down, and she just kicked off singing You'll Never Walk Alone. And I'd never expected it from this woman, and it was just amazing. And she had a real school mom warbling voice, you know, and it was just so moving, because what she must have felt to do that, because this woman would, you know, she wasn't about that, but she'd been sort of taken to that extreme. And, you know, families were like, where'd you go from here? And I was party to being involved with six families, and through people I knew, and was able to get advice for free and stuff, and got six families for judicial review of the inquest verdict. And we spent a week in the High Court. We were successful in getting leave. We went to the High Court, and it got kicked out after a week. We knew after the first day we were getting nowhere. One of the judges sat literally like this, you know, sort of scratching his head, eyes closed half the time. And in his final summation, as you know, to why we got nowhere, referred to the semi-final between Liverpool and Sheffield Wednesday. So, you know, when you got that level of ignorance, you know, where does it get you? And so I'm skipping loads because, I'm trying to condense 20 years, and please stop me if I'm going on a little bit too long. But from my point of view, from working on a project which did the first critical analysis of Hillsborough, and we published several pieces of work, I left that project because I had difficulty with equating earning a living out of the work I was doing. I had a real ethical dilemma. It was I was meant to do a PhD out of it. So I think there's probably about three people now walking around with PhDs that should be mine because the work just went elsewhere. But, you know, I still sleep at night. And I went back to, I left the project for lots of reasons because I was being pulled away. Because I was unearthing the contentious stuff, I was being dragged away and told to come and sit behind a desk and write whatever, and, you know, you're getting too involved and don't be too critical of the police and don't do this, don't that. And the project I was supposed to be I was working on was supposed to be radical, and this is, you know, so just don't get me on left-wing academics, you know, because it's an industry. So I left and went back to my another job, also in academia, I have to, but, and continued doing this voluntary and working with families. And at that time, the group that the main organised group was the Hillsborough Family Support Group, which had been set up after the disaster and was made up of families who'd lost people at Hillsborough. A lot of those families felt that survivors should be involved because obviously the role they had, not only were they victims of the day, but also they had crucial evidence. But that wasn't to be, and over time, what you got with Hillsborough was, like anything else, a disaster occurs, there's a commonality. Those people who've lost people, they come together and they mourn collectively because of that common incident. But over time, differences emerge. People were different in so many ways, politically, class become a real thing. I saw such divisions of how people were treated, depending on their accent and depending on the postcode, and really awful things I saw. And over time, really big differences emerged. And the group I'm involved with, the Justice Campaign, I have to say that I tried, the bereaved families that formed our group, I argued against them breaking away from the main group, and I said, if you want to change something, you know, you just, and I was basically, you know, just have a go at changing it from within. You're saying, you know, it's just committee-led and no one has the right to, you know, you say something, it's ignored, whatever. Just try and change it. Try and, you know, sort of get your views across, get on the committee, whatever. But it just couldn't be. And if I can just give you, and this isn't meant as a, you know, obviously I do have criticisms of individuals within that group, but just to give you the one example and the turning point at which our families walked away was, it was suggested that the family support group meet with the son and discuss with the son. And some of the families, the hierarchy, and I say hierarchy because that was what it became, argued, well, it's a big selling newspaper and it's got lots of money behind it. Maybe it could help us fight for justice. So you can imagine the responses of people like Dave Church and people that you knew, Daniel. And basically, it went to they put it to the vote, and the vote went in the favour of those who didn't want to speak to the son. And so the chair of the family support group said, okay, well, I as chair won't speak to the son, but me as a father, I'm going to speak to them and you won't stop us. So the committee met with the Sun newspaper, and that was the point at which families went, can't take any more, and formed this group to be a more proactive group that incorporated survivors and people like myself who support the issue of fighting for justice. And that's basically why there's two groups. So we're a much broader church. And what's happened over the years of the existence of the Justice Campaign is that, and this is what I've become aware of, is the confidence that a lot of survivors have gained from feeling that they've got a voice. Firstly, a lot of survivors, and it still distresses me because I still come across people who feel guilty because they're alive. They don't even acknowledge their heroism, because if it wasn't for the heroic acts of those supporters on the day, the death toll would have been much greater than 96. Make no bones about that. They got out the pens, and some of them were physically injured themselves, and they were ripping down hoardings, pushing through police. A journalist I spoke with the other week said that he was told he was ripping hoardings down, he got out the pen, and the police stopped him and said, there's no excuse for vandalism, I don't care what's going on, stop them. You know, and it does so much of it becomes laughable because you just go, it's a parallel universe there that you know, survivors were seeing this, football were seeing this, and you touched on it, it's crowd control versus crowd safety. And what I would say, tying in with that, is in terms of not seeing those signs of distress, I went to the Hillsborough ground when the jury went, when I was at the inquest, and so we had a look around. I was with one of the bereaved fathers, and I was on the Leppings Lane terrace, and he was in the control box, and then he came down to me, and he went, just go up there and look at what you can see with the naked eye, and then ask them to zoom in, you know, with the monitor. It was very clear to see, make out characteristics with the human eye. With a zoom, you could make out the colour of people's eyes. The idea that someone couldn't see distress in those pens is, you know, it's so telling. The argument is that Duckenfield, the main guy, wasn't even in the box at the time, the control box. The videotapes went missing, you know, at the time as well. But basically, people... the whole context in which it happened was around just pushing people back into pens. When the gate onto the perimeter fence, when the gate burst open and fans burst out because of the pressure, they were pushed back in. And I've been in court and seen police officers, I've been in the inquest and seen police officers stand up and say, yes, 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 I pushed them back in. Now that says either, you know, I don't know how they're trained, that you can't see that distress, or to ignore that distress, I find it so distressing that that is who we're policed by. So basically, you were getting the arrogance of people being able to give that kind of evidence in front of families and show no. And I was always one to see, oh, people are going to be distressed when they come to terms with what they've done. No way. I then subsequently watched the two major officers, Duckenfield and Murray, in at the private prosecutions in Leeds. I didn't support the private prosecutions. I thought they were a waste of time because they were never going to get anywhere. And I have to say, you know, I'm sure if any of you are in court, I'm sure you'd like to go into court with a cast iron guarantee that if you're found guilty, you'll not go to prison. Those officers went into that in court, the court in Leeds, with a guarantee, and this was for lawyers acting for the family support group, that they didn't necessarily want them to go to prison. If they were found guilty, they didn't want them to get a custodial sentence. It wasn't discussed with other families. So you see all the time, I mean, basically what you've got to buy in off exercises all along the line. And, you know, this is commonplace, isn't it? There's always people who have the price, and then thankfully there's some of us that don't have a price. So I watched those two officers, though, in Leeds. I attended there, and in terms of, you know, our civil rights, this group, we had a tremendous time. We were threatened with imprisonment if we launched our website, and we held back on launching the website the day before the, I think it was the 10th anniversary or the 11th, whatever anniversary it was. I was sitting in Leeds High Court with John Glover, Dave Church, and a survivor, myself, and we were threatened with imprisonment because of our website. All it does is tell the truth. So we held off launching it until after the cases had finished, and then it was the server pulled it, and now we host it abroad. But basically, what I'm saying is the attempts to kind of control anyone who was getting near to the truth of Hillsborough. And over the years, every avenue is closed. The Labour Party, when it was in opposition, said that if it got into power, it would call for there would be a new inquiry. Jack Straw, in particular, said there would be a new inquiry. So when the Labour government got in, what occurred was not an inquiry. It was Lord Justice Stuart Smith, and it was the Stuart Smith scrutiny, more commonly known in Liverpool as the Stuart Smith stitch-up, because what happened was we went to him, and we went... Well, he started off on the first day by saying to the secretary of the family support group, Phil Hammond, oh, hello, Mr. Hammond, are the rest of your committee with you, or are they like the Liverpool fans arriving late on the day? Yeah. And that's well documented, that. And he actually, I think it's on camera, that,
no,
as well.
He's admitted it.
Yeah. And because he apologised, he had to apologise.
I should add it as well, just because I know this for a fact, that Lord Justice Stuart Smith, even at that time, was known as the most right-wing judge in Britain, and for Jack Straw to select him for that job was with the knowledge of exactly what he was going to do, and that he'd already for 5-10 years played that role in the Court of Appeal for the government, that whenever they wanted a right-wing decision in a contentious case, he would sit in it as the chair.
But the scrutiny as well, there was no power behind it anyway. There was no real power. It wasn't a public inquiry. And so we all went to him painstakingly with evidence, like Tony Edwards, the ambulance officer, other evidence. And we sat there, I remember being with Dave and Maureen Church, and we gave this evidence to him. Now, the best thing about this for me is he didn't ignore the evidence, because we were brought down to the House of Commons, because it was going to be announced in the House. Jack Smith invited us down. Ominously, we met in room 13 in the House. And he said, "We've listened to what you've said, and we've taken on board what you've said. In fact, we've written it, you know, yes, police did change statements. Here's a copy of a statement before. Here's a copy after it's been altered." And this, I just think, was part and parcel of, you know, sort of how we live now. It was the whole setting of that tone, because he went, "But there's nothing we're going to do about it, because it wouldn't make any difference anyway." But what it did do, it did make a difference, because it closed another legal avenue. So, because then they'd say, "Oh, but you've had another inquiry." They kept trying to say that was an inquiry. And so it just leaves people with nowhere to go. Anne Williams, who lost her son Kevin, has gone back to the Attorney General on numerous occasions, asking for the inquest verdict to be quashed, because the evidence in Kevin's case is overwhelming, that he was alive after 3:15. The policewoman says she carried him into the gymnasium, which was the temporary mortuary, and he opened his eyes and said, "Mum," and that was 4:00. Now, you imagine as a mother having to live with that. That police officer who gave that, she didn't give that evidence, she made a statement to that effect. She was bullied and browbeat by the West Midlands police. I mean, we found that officer. That was the only reason, you know, we found her. We found the other police officer. She's never given that evidence in open court. So you have to ask why. And so all the time, doors are closing. I mean, Anne took her, the case went to Europe and was dismissed just a month ago. The argument being it was out of time. She should have gone just after Lord Justice Stuart Smith's scrutiny. So to take it up just to the 20th anniversary and last week, what you had in Liverpool was like it was yesterday. It was just, you know, it was so tangible. It was like Hillsborough happened yesterday. But anyway, the memorial, the ground was just packed. And I don't think Liverpool had really allowed for that. There was some criticism, actually, of how people got in there and stuff. But anyway, as you know, or you probably know, Andy Burnham came onto the pitch, and no one knew. None of us knew he was going to be there. He didn't go there unannounced. He went there because he had been invited. And, you know, but there lies another story. But anyway, people started to listen to him, but the minute he said, you know, "I'm here on behalf of Gordon Brown, the government, on behalf of the government, whatever," it was amazing. I mean, you know, we spoke about it before, and I've watched it over and over again. It was just, you know, do you call it de-individuation when a group acts as an individual? And just, you know, and it was amazing, because there was this anger, and there was this, you know, "Don't come here unless you're going to do something," because we, you know, sympathy is useless. Yeah. People don't want sympathy. They've had 20 years of it. You know, if you, and especially when people are in a position when they could do something. And I was asked, when he made comments the other month about, oh, if there was any new evidence, we'd consider it. I was asked in an interview, well, have you got any new evidence, you know, that he could consider? And I said, there doesn't need to be new evidence. All he has to do is go away and order an inquiry into evidence after 3:15 on the day of the disaster. That's never been heard in open court, that evidence. So when he came last Wednesday, you know, he had to take it on the chin, because, you know, you get 32,000 people shouting it down. It was so powerful, because you can imagine the mix within that group in terms of their politics, everything about them. There'd be huge differences. What they had going for them was they weren't all Liverpool supporters. There were people from everywhere there, and I know that because of people who came from abroad. But just right across, people were shouting for justice. Now, on the back of that, people were saying, there's been all this stuff in the press at the weekend about Jackie Smith asking the chief constable of South Yorkshire to release papers and for the 30-year ruling to be relaxed, etc. And everyone was getting a bit excited yesterday, and people were ringing me up, and I just said, well, I can't get excited about this. For one, I don't know that it's true. But secondly, I can't get excited about evidence which is held by South Yorkshire Police, which has been gathered by West Midlands Police, that they've had 20 years to go through. I can't get excited about that evidence being released because it's been doctored from day one. Videos went missing the day of the disaster. The cover-up began on the day of the disaster. I said, I can only begin to get excited if there was an independent inquiry where those issues will be heard. And you know, I agree entirely. There will not be justice, and that sounds terrible for me, from the Hill for Justice campaign. That doesn't mean to say you don't campaign for it, you don't argue for it, you keep chipping away. But there's a shift here. I feel there's a shift, and I think there's going to be a buying off exercise somewhere along the line. And I might be wrong, but I just feel something's going to come, something will give. And before I came here tonight, I actually got a phone call off the Chief Constable of South Yorkshire. I was in BCFM, is it? Yeah? The radio? Yep. And I got a phone call after I'd done the interview there, but I know he'd been trying to get me all day. And he said, his name is Merid Hughes, and I thought he said he was Med News. You know, the news station, like... And I was like, sort of just got into like saying, oh yeah, what do you want and everything. And then I realised he was the chief constable, and I said, oh, I thought you were a journalist, whatever. But anyway, basically, he rang me because he, on behalf of the campaign, he rang me basically to say he's sick of being misquoted in the press. And Jackie Smith has never contacted him at all. So all this stuff in the press yesterday wasn't true anyway. And basically, what he said several weeks ago was there's more than 300 boxes of evidence in the archives in South Yorkshire Police. And he wanted them to be looked through and see what legally he could release. That's as much as he said. And he said the first contact he had with Jackie Smith was this morning when he rang her to say, what's all this about you telling me about releasing this stuff? So basically, he said, and not to do him a disservice, I've still got it on there. I wrote being up on the back of Don't Buy the Sun thing like that. He said that his background is he was a public order specialist, and you know, he wasn't involved in Hillsborough at the time and whatever. And over 300 boxes, which he would release legally anything that he could. And he said he's not interested in any cover-up, and he thinks probably there'd be things in there that neither side would like to hear. And he said he rang Jackie Smith, and one of the bases he rang her was, he said he can't deploy men to look through those and what could be released. He needs money offer to look through them. So I volunteered my services free of charge. But he declined. He said, thank you for the offer and nice try. Yeah. I meant it as well. I'd be more than happy to stay. But you know, the reality, so there you have it. The reality is, there's these boxes which have been, you know, gathered in this way that I've explained. And before they get to the families or the families' representatives, the police are going to go through them again to see what they can see and can't see. So you see, all the time, that's why there's never going to be any justice, you know? And all you can hope for is that you're public about all this, I think, because what I've noticed over Hillsborough is that, you know, I speak with survivors and families who, they'd argue they had no politics, and they did read The Sun before Hillsborough. And, you know, like, I mean, you didn't read The Sun before Hillsborough for loads of reasons that had nothing to do, you know, with Hillsborough. But lots of these did read it, and they read it for the sport and whatever. And, you know, we've run a boycott of The Sun since 1989. And you look at the sales of The Sun on Merseyside. The Sun have made so many attempts to get into us and, you know, try and make amends. And it is a success story, that boycott. But basically, I've seen the politicisation of so many people through this, and in a way, that's the only heartening thing for me, is when they begin to understand other struggles, because, I come from Liverpool. Historically, it's a very sectarian city. Where my background is Irish Catholic. I grew up on a dividing line, and we still have 12th of July Orange Lodge marches. So I come from that kind of city where you will only get that in Glasgow and in the six counties. I've seen people sort of go beyond that now in terms of how they see